Mating underneath your bedroom at 3 in the morning, you have missed one of life's more sensational moments. It is an uncommon event, to say the least. If you've ever heard cats fighting in the night, well, you have a clue. Magnify the volume and the intensity by 10. It's not what you'd call a sensual and erotic sound. More like a 3-alarm fire is what it is. I remember the first time it happened. Since conditions were not really conducive to sleep, I got up. When I say I got up, I mean I got up about 3 feet up, straight up, covers and all. When I had recovered my aplomb and adjusted to the new adrenaline level, I got a flashlight and went outside in the rain and peered under the house. This lady raccoon and her suitor were squared off in a corner, fangs bared, hissing, covered with mud and blood, and not looking very sexy at all. Neither my presence nor the beam of light could override what drove them on. With snarls and barks and screams, the passionate encounter raged on. While I watched, the matter was finally consummated and resolved. They had no shame. What had to be done was done, and they wandered off in a kind of glazy-eyed stupor to groom themselves for whatever might come next in the life of a raccoon. I sat there in the rain, my light still shining into the trysting chamber, and I pondered, why is it that love and life so often have to be carried forth with so much pain and strain and mess? I ask you, why is that? I was thinking of my own sweet wife in the bed right above me, and our own noises of conflict mixed with affection. I wondered what the raccoons must conclude from the sounds a husband and wife make at night. The ones that sound like, if you really love me, you would not keep making such a mess in the bathroom, followed by, oh yeah, well, let me tell you a few things. Why isn't love easy? I don't know. And the raccoons don't say. Now, let me tell you about Larry Walters, my hero. Walters is a truck driver, 33 years old. He is sitting in his lawn chair in his backyard, wishing he could fly. For as long as he could remember, he wanted to go up, to be able just to rise right up in the air and see for a long way. But the time, the money, the education, and opportunity to be a pilot were not his, and hang gliding was too dangerous, and any good place for gliding was too far away, so he spent a lot of summer afternoons sitting in his backyard in his ordinary old aluminum lawn chair, the kind with the webbing and the rivets, just like the one you've probably got in your backyard. The next chapter in this story is carried by the newspapers and television. There's old Larry Walters up in the air over Los Angeles, flying at last, really getting up there, still sitting in his aluminum lawn chair. But it's hooked onto 45 helium-filled surplus weather balloons. Larry has a parachute on, a CB radio, a six-pack of beer, some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and a BB gun to pop some of the balloons to come down. And instead of being just a couple of 100 feet over his neighborhood, he shot up 11,000 feet right through the approach corridor to Los Angeles International Airport. Walters is a taciturn man. When asked by the press why he did it, he said, well, you can't just sit there. When asked if he was scared, he answered, oh, wonderfully so. When asked if he would do it again, he said, no. And asked if he was glad that he did it, he grinned from ear to ear and said, oh, yes. The human race sits in its chair. On the one hand is the message that says there's nothing left to do. And on the other hand, people like Larry Walters are busy tying balloons to their chairs, directed by dreams and imagination to do their thing. The human race sits in its chair. On the one hand is the message that the human situation is hopeless. And meanwhile, people like Larry Walters soar upward, knowing anything is possible, sending back the message from 11,000 feet, I did it! I really did it! I'm flying! It's the spirit here that counts. The time may be long, the vehicle may be strange or unexpected, but if the dream is held close to the heart and imagination is applied to what there is close in hand, then everything is still possible. But wait, some cynic from the edge of the crowd insists that human beings still can't really fly, not like birds, anyway.
True.
But somewhere, in some little garage, some maniac with a gleam in his eyes, scarfing vitamins and mineral supplements and practicing flapping his arms faster and faster and faster. Now, here is the truth about Larry Walters, the rest of the story. The great balloon chair ride happened in 1982. I first wrote about it at that time. And I told Larry's story for years afterward. Truly, he was a hero to me. As it turned out, some of my facts about Larry and his ride were wrong, and there is a sequel to the story, an ending. That is, not an ending, really. First of all, Larry did not go up to 11,000 feet. Actually, it was 16,000 feet, more than 3 miles up. And we know that from the pilots of the TWA and Delta Airliners who found Larry in their airspace, 16,000 feet in a lawn chair over Los Angeles. Think about it. He did have a seatbelt, but he was so excited he forgot to buckle it. And the rest of his gear included an altimeter, a compass, flashlight, extra batteries, beef jerky, a California road map, and a first aid kit. This was no spur-of-the-moment event. Larry was prepared. His glasses fell off on ascent, and he dropped the BB gun he was going to use to pop balloons to control his altitude. He crash-landed into power lines and blacked out a whole neighborhood. Larry's amazing feat did not go unpunished. The FAA cited him for, among other things, and I quote, "operating a civil aircraft for which there is not currently in effect an airworthiness certificate," and "for being in an airport space and not contacting the control tower." They fined him $1,500. And for a while, Larry was famous. The New York Times, The Tonight Show, Letterman, all that. If you want to know all the details, go to www.markberry.com on the Internet. Mr. Berry is an authority on Larry Walters. He has gathered photographs of the launching site, Larry in the air, and the crash site. Mr. Berry has even located the actual lawn chair, which Larry had given to a neighborhood kid. How I would like to have that chair to sit in. But it's on its way to the Smithsonian. Besides, Larry would say I should get my own chair and get my own balloons and fly. There is, as I suggested at the beginning, an end to the Larry Walters story that is, well, not an end. 10 years after his flight, on October the 6th, 1993, Larry Walters went hiking in the Angeles National Forest alone. He shot himself in the heart and died. Why? Why? Well, we don't know why. Nobody saw this coming. Larry left no word. I guess the depth of his private despair matched the height of his great imagination. Larry's photograph is on my wall. In the photograph, he's way, way up there, and now, of course, he's up there somewhere, forever. His tombstone says simply, "Larry Walters, April 19, 1949, October the 6th, 1993, lawn chair pilot, beloved." While I'm on the subject of balloons, I'll keep going. There's more. I'm thinking back to the fourth day of the month of June, 1783, more than 200 years ago. The market square of the French village of Annonay, not far from Paris. On a raised platform, a smoky bonfire fed by wet straw and old wool rags. Tethered above, straining at its lines, a huge taffeta bag, a balloon, 33 feet in diameter. In the presence of, quote, "a respectable assembly and a great many other people," unquote, and accompanied by great cheering, the balloon was cut from its moorings and set free to rise majestically into the noontide sky. 6,000 feet into the air it went, and came to earth several miles away in a field, where it was attacked by pitchfork-waving peasants and torn to pieces as an instrument of evil. the first public ascent of a balloon, and the first step in the history of human flight. Old Benjamin Franklin was there, in France as the agent of the new American states, he of the key and the kite and the lightning and the bifocals and the printing press, our guy. When a bystander asked what possible good this balloon thing could be, Franklin made the memorable retort, "Well, what good is a newborn baby?" A man of such curiosity and imagination could provide an answer to his own question, and in his own journal he wrote, "This balloon will open the skies to mankind." The peasants, too, were not far from wrong. It was also a harbinger of great evil for the village of Annonay, which one day would be leveled by bombs falling from the sky from aeroplanes. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Some months before that June day, Joseph Michel Montgolfier sat one evening staring into his fireplace, watching sparks and smoke rise up the chimney from the evening fire. His imagination rose with the smoke. His smoke floated into the sky. Why not capture it and put it in a bag and see if the bag would rise, perhaps carrying something or someone with it? In his mid-40s, the son of a prosperous papermaker, a believer in the great church that was science in the 18th century, a brilliant and impatient man with time on his hands, was Monsieur Montgolfier. And so, with his younger, more methodical brother Etienne, and the resources of their father's factory, he set to work, with paper bags, then silken ones, and finally taffeta coated with rosins. And voila! Came a day when from the gardens of Versailles a balloon carrying a sheep, a rooster, and a duck went up. All survived, proving that there were no poisonous gases in the sky, as some had feared. The most enthusiastic supporter of the brothers Montgolfier was a young chemist, Jean-François Pilote de Rosiers. He didn't want to make balloons, he wanted to go up in one. The Montgolfiers' interest was in scientific experimentation. They were older, wiser, groundlings. Pilote wanted to fly. He was full of adventure and youth, and so that fall, November the 21st, 1783, Jean-François Pilote de Rosiers got his wish. In the garden of the royal palace at La Mouette, in the Bois de Boulogne, at 1:54 p.m., in a magnificent balloon 7 stories high, painted with signs of the zodiac and the king's monogram. Up, up, and away he went, higher than treetops and church steeples, coming down beyond the Seine, 5 miles away. Joseph Michel and Etienne Montgolfier lived long and productive scientific lives, and they died in their beds, safe on the ground. They never went up. But 2 years after his historic flight, trying to cross the English Channel west to east in a balloon, the young Jean-François Pilote de Rosiers plummeted from the sky in flames to his death. But his great-great-grandson was later to become one of the first airplane pilots in France. Well, you might well ask, what's all this about? Anyway, why am I telling you all this? Well, it's about the power and the price of imagination. Imagination is more important than information. Einstein said that, and he should know. It's also a story about how people of imagination stand on one another's shoulders, from the ground to the balloon, to the man in the balloon, to the man on the moon. Yes. And some of us, like the Montgolfiers, are forever ground crew, holding lines, building fires, dreaming dreams, letting go and watching the upward flight, and others of us are bound for the sky and the far edges of things. All that's in the story, too. These things come to mind at the time of year when children graduate to the next stage of things, from high school, from college, from the nest of the parent. What shall we give them on these occasions? Imagination, a shove out and up, a blessing. Come over here, we say. To the edge, we say. Let us show you something, we say. We are afraid, they say. It's very exciting, they say. Come to the edge, we say. Use your imagination. And they come, and they look, and we push, and they fly. We to stay and die in our beds, they to go and die, howsoever, yet inspiring those who come after them to find their own edge and fly. These things also come to mind in the middle years of my own life. I, too, intend to live a long and useful life and die safe in my bed on the ground, but the anniversary of that little event in the village of Annonay, June 4th, just happens to be my birthday. And on its bicentennial, I went up in a balloon from a field near the small Skagit Valley village of Laconner. Up, up, and away. It's never too late to fly. Well, from the sublime to the mundane, I will now talk about laundry. For a long time, I was in charge of the laundry at our house. I liked my work. In an odd way, it gave me a feeling of involvement with the rest of the family. It also gave me time alone in the back room without the rest of the family, which was also nice sometimes. I actually like sorting the clothes, the lights, the darks, and in-betweens. I like setting the dials, hot, cold, rinse, time, heat. These are simple choices I can understand and make with decisive skill. I still haven't figured out our new stereo, but washers and dryers I can handle. The bell dings. You pull out the warm, fluffy clothes, take them to the dining room table, sort, fold them into neat piles. I especially like it when there's lots of static electricity and you can hang socks all over your body and they will stick there. When I'm finished, I have a sense of accomplishment, a sense of competence. I am good at doing the laundry, at least that. And it's a religious experience, you know. It involves water and earth and fire, polarities of wet and dry, hot and cold, dirty and clean, the great cycles, round and round, beginning and end, alpha and omega. Amen. I am in touch with the great something or other, for a moment at least. Life is tidy, has meaning. But then, again, well, the washing machine died last week. I guess I overloaded it with towels, and the load got all lumped up on one side during the spin cycle. So it did this incredible herky-jerky, lurching dance across the floor and blew itself up. I thought it was coming for me. One minute it was a living thing in the throes of a seizure, and the next minute it was a cold white box full of partially digested towels with froth around its mouth, because I guess I must have fed it too much soap, too. 5 minutes later, the dryer expired. Two dead appliances, like a couple of elderly folks in a nursing home who follow one another quickly in death, so closely are they entwined. Well, it was Saturday afternoon, and all the towels in the house were wet, and all my shorts and socks were wet, and now what? Knowing full well that if you want one of those repair guys, you have to stay home for 36 hours straight and have your banker standing by with a certified check, or else they won't set foot on your property, and I haven't got time for that. So it's the laundromat over at the mall. Now, I haven't spent a Saturday night in the laundromat since I was in college. What you miss by not going to laundromats anymore are things like seeing other people's clothes and overhearing conversations you'd never hear anywhere else. For example, I watched an old lady sort out a lot of sexy black underwear and wondered if it was hers or not. And I heard a college kid explain in great detail to a friend just how to get puke off a suede jacket. No easy feat. Sitting there waiting, I contemplated the detergent box. I used cheer. I liked the idea of a happy wash. Sitting there late at night, leaning against the dryer for warmth, eating a little cheese and crackers and drinking a little white wine out of the thermos, I came prepared. I got to brooding about the meaning of life and started reading the stuff on the cheer box. Amazing! It contains ingredients to lift dirt from clothes, anionic surfactants, and soften water, complex sodium phosphates, also agents to protect washer parts, sodium silicate, and improve processing, sodium sulfate. Small quantities of stuff to reduce wrinkling and prevent fabric yellowing, plus whiteners, colorant, and perfume. No kidding. All this for less than a nickel an ounce. It's biodegradable, works best in cold water, ecologically sound, a miracle in a box. Sitting there watching the laundry go around in the dryer, I thought about the round world and hygiene. We've made a lot of progress, you know. We used to think that disease was an act of God. Then we figured out it was a product of human ignorance. So we've been cleaning up our act, literally, ever since. We've been getting the excrement off our hands and clothes and bodies and food and houses. If only the scientific experts could come up with something to get it off our minds. One cup of fix-it frizzle that will lift the dirt from our lives, soften our hardness, protect our inner parts, improve our processing, reduce our yellowing and wrinkling, improve our natural color and make us sweet and good. Oh, how I wish. Don't try cheer, by the way. I tasted it. It's awful. But I suppose my tongue is clean now. I'll add a parenthesis to that old story. In reconsidering the kindergarten book, I was tempted to leave the story out. I don't do the laundry very much anymore, but sometimes I do. And for the same reason, other people sometimes weed a garden or clean out a kitchen drawer, doing a straightforward, clear-cut task that has a beginning and an end, balances out the complexity without end that often vexes the rest of my life. I think of this as sacred simplicity. And yes, I still stick things to my body with electricity. PolyPro really works well. I once got everything in the dryer to cling to me long enough for me to walk through the kitchen and demonstrate my skill. It made my grandchildren roar with laughter, which was the whole idea. My wife doesn't laugh much about it anymore, but I have a new audience. As to soap, I admit I've tried Bold Power, Tide, True Grit, and Arm & Hammer just because I like the notion of having muscle in my washing powder and because I am a sucker for colorful packaging. Any old product that says new and improved on it calls out to me, for I, too, hope to be new and improved someday. From the laundry now to the matter of medicine cabinets. I was just wondering, did you ever go to somebody's house for dinner or party or something and then use the family bathroom, and while you were in there, did you ever take a look in the medicine cabinet just to compare notes, you know? Didn't you ever just look around a little? I have a friend who does it all the time. He claims he's doing research for a PhD in sociology, and he says a lot of other people snoop in medicine cabinets too. And they aren't working on a PhD in sociology. It's not something people talk about much because you think you might be the only one who is doing it, and you don't want people to think you're strange, right? My friend says if you want to know the truth about people, the bathroom is the place to begin. All you have to do is look in the drawers and shelves and cabinets and take a look at the ratty old robes and pajamas and nightgowns hanging on the hook behind the door. You get the picture. He says all their habits and hopes and dreams and sorrows and illnesses and hang-ups and even their sex life all stand revealed in that one small room. He says most people are secret slobs. He says the deepest mysteries of the race are tucked into the nooks and crannies of the bathroom, where we go to be alone, to confront ourselves in the mirror, to comb and curry and scrape our hides, to coax our aging and ailing bodies into one more day, to clean ourselves and relieve ourselves, to paint and deodorize our surfaces, to meditate and consult our oracle and attempt to improve our lot. He says it's all there in the bathroom, in cans and bottles and tubes and boxes and vials, potions and oils, unguents, sprays, tools, lotions, perfumes and appliances and soaps and paste and pills and creams and pads and powder and medicine and devices beyond description. Some electric and some not. The wonders of the ages in our bathroom. He says he finds most bathrooms are about the same and gives him a sense of the wondrous unity of the human race. Now, I don't intend to start an epidemic of spelunking in people's bathrooms, but I did just go in and take a look at my own. I get the picture, and I don't know whether to laugh or cry. There I am. Go take a look in your own temple of reality. And note that from now on, please go to the bathroom at home if you visit me. My bathroom is closed to the public. Here's a topic close to my heart. Too close, as you will see. It's about jumper cables. Hey, you got jumper cables, buddy? Sure, I got jumper cables. English teacher and his nice, sweet wife from Nampa, Idaho, as I found out later. And their funny little foreign car drove around Seattle with their lights on in the morning fog and left the lights on when they went in for coffee and so forth and so on. Dead meat now. Need jumper cables. Need Good Samaritan. Need a friendly hand from someone who looks like he knows what to do with jumper cables, and the good fairy of fate placed them in my hands. Men are supposed to know about jumper cables. It's supposed to be in the genetic code, right? But some of us men are mental mutants, and if it's under the hood of a car, well, it's voodoo, Jack, and that's the end of it. Besides, this guy only asked me if I had jumper cables. He didn't ask me if I knew how to use them. I thought, by the way, he asked that he knew what he was doing. After all, he had an Idaho license plate and was wearing a baseball cap and cowboy boots. All those people know about jumper cables when they're born, don't they? I guess he thought a white-bearded old man wearing hiking boots and driving a 20-year-old VW van in Seattle was bound to use jumper cables often and with authority. So I get out my cables, and we swaggered around being all macho and cool and talking automobile talk, and we looked under the hood of his rig, and there's no battery. Hell, I said, there's your problem right there. Somebody stole your battery. Dang, he said. The battery is under the back seat, dear, said his nice sweet wife. Oh. Well, so we took all the luggage and travel junk out of the back seat and hauled the seat out into the parking lot, and sure enough, there it was, a battery, right there, just asking for jumper cables to be laid on. I began to get worried when the guy smirked at his wife and said under his breath to me that he took auto mechanics and sex education at the same time in high school, and they had been confused in his mind ever since when it came to where things were and what you did to get any action out of them. And we laughed. It's a guy thing. His wife didn't laugh at all. She just pulled out the manual and started thumbing through it. Anyway, the sum of our knowledge was that positive poles and negative poles were involved, and either one or both cars ought to be running, and 6-volt and 12-volt batteries and other volt batteries did or did not work out. I thought he knew what he was doing and kind of went along with it, and I guess he did the same, and we hooked it all up real tight, turned the ignition key on both cars at the same time, and there was this electrical arc between the cars that not only fried his ignition system, it welded the jumper cables to my battery and knocked the baseball cap off his head. The sound was like one of the world's largest flies hitting one of those electric killer screens, zish, accompanied by an awesome blue flash and some smoke. Power is an amazing thing. We just sat down right there in the back seat of his car, which was still sitting out there in the parking lot, awed by what we had accomplished. And his wife went off with the manual to find some intelligent help, and we talked as coolly and wisely as we could in the face of the circumstances. He said, ignorance and power and pride are a deadly mixture, you know. As I said, he was an English teacher. English teachers talk like that. Sure, I said. Like matches in the hands of a 3-year-old, or automobiles in the hands of a 16-year-old, or faith in God in the mind of a saint or a maniac, or nuclear arsenal in the hands of a movie character, or even jumper cables and batteries in the hands of fools. And we were trying to get something cosmic and serious out of our own invocation of power, you see, humbled as we were. Sometime later, I got a present in the mail from Nampa, Idaho, from the guy's nice sweet wife, as a gesture of grace, forgiveness combined with instruction and admonition to go and sin no more. What she sent was a set of electronic, true-start, foolproof, tangle-free jumper cables, complete with instructions that tell you everything and more than you ever wanted to know about jumper cables in English and Spanish. The set is designed so that when you get everything all hooked up, a little solid-state switch control box tells you if you've done it right or not before any juice flows. Gives you time to think if you really want to go ahead. Occurs to me we could all use a device like that between us and power, I guess. It's nice to know that progress in such things is possible in the face of ignorance and pride. Progress is possible. Next time, he'll ask his wife first. Good Samaritans like me may be handy and enthusiastic, but if they are really dumb, they aren't much help. Now, this line of thinking keeps going in a new essay called The Bad Samaritan. Are you interested in humility avoidance and escaping a dumb death? Well, I can help. Every time I do the same dimwit thing again, I mutter, I'll never learn. As if acknowledging ignorance takes care of the problem. Yet, sometimes I get it straight. Learn something by heart so firmly, I'll take the knowledge with me to my grave. Here's my most recent triumph. If you woke me up out of a sound sleep in the middle of the night and shouted, battery cables, Fulgem, I'd sit up in bed and rap out my mantra. Separate and off. Red to good red. Red to bad red. Black to good black. Black to engine block. Start good car. Start bad car. Wait and reverse. Yes! Be impressed. I've got this thing down, nailed, internalized. Never again would you find me standing by at a dead battery scene, red-faced and ashamed of both my stupidity and what I'm about to go ahead and do anyhow. The motivation? Humiliation. Again and again and again, humiliation. Frying an ignition system or two, getting zapped flat by jumping juice, being laughed at by my grandchildren when I tried to help a stranded motorist, and finally, when I didn't stop to help, a nice lady holding a scrawl sign saying, dead battery, need help. And my wife gave me her What's Wrong With You lecture. It was enough. It was time to stop being the bad Samaritan. So I consulted several experts, real experts, a clerk at an auto parts emporium, a woman at a battery store, a driver for a AAA rescue truck, my friend Fred at my local gas station, and a 17-year-old kid who builds hot rods. They all gave me the same instructions. So what I'm about to give you is high-end information. Listen carefully. I will elaborate. First, always use battery cables. Speaker wire or metal clothesline won't do. Second, make sure the two cars are close, but get this, not touching with the power off. Third, attach red clamp to the good car battery on the side of battery with plus. Fourth, attach red clamp to plus side of bad battery. Fifth, attach black clamp to minus side of good battery. Sixth, attach black clamp to engine block of car with dead battery. Why not to the minus side of the bad battery, you ask? Well, if there is a spark when attaching the last cable and the old battery is emitting fumes, which sometimes happens, you might cause an explosion and damage parts of you. Grounding the cable away from the battery avoids this possibility. When everything is connected, pray. Start the engine of the car with the good battery, wait a little, then start the car with the dead battery, wait a little again to give the dead battery some life. If this doesn't work, call your mom. She probably knows more about what to do next than your dad does. He'll just give you a lot of voodoo moves that used to work on his old truck back when he was in high school. She'll tell you to call AAA or a tow truck. Now, using modern memory techniques, I have reduced all this complex information, my mantra, to even simpler information. All I need to remember is this phrase, Aretha Franklin, the American Red Cross, and death. Three things. I can reconstruct the whole battery procedure from these three concepts. Consider, Aretha is famous for a tune called Respect, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, and that's the required mental attitude for every part of this job, respect. Electricity is dangerous. Think. The American Red Cross, of course, is the place to begin with the red cable at the positive plus sign and so on. And death is what will happen if I don't remember to put the last black cable on a grounded place. Sounds good, but with my luck, though, I'll still panic. I can see me now standing there in the rain on some dark and stormy night, trying to explain to some poor soul about how the battery cable deal depends on remembering three simple things, Lena Horne, the Salvation Army, and severe illness.
What?
The bad Samaritan strikes again. Enough of battery cables already. Women, I notice, tend to think those stories are funny, and guys seem to react as if I've given away large secrets. But basically, they're not about battery cables. Those stories are about education, as this next one, which is entitled Bar Story. But it's about learning something. Real education comes in unexpected places. Real teachers know that. When I began graduate school, I needed a job, a night job, one that paid good money for short hours, not easy to find. In desperation, I accepted employment as a bartender in a hotel. That sounds okay, doesn't it? Any problem with being a bartender? Well, actually, yes, or so I thought at the time. Graduate school, in my case, was a theological seminary, a school for ministers. Working as a bartender could get me suspended from school. That's what I thought after I took the job, and that's what my wife thought after I took the job, and my friends thought the same thing. Bad move. In a defiant frame of mind, I decided to turn myself into the authorities at the school. Before the gossip got around, I would just march into the dean's office and put it on the line. I've got a job as a bartender. What are you going to do about that? The dean gave me his shrewdest look, a look I would learn over time to respect as an early warning sign of a real educational experience. Wonderful, he exclaimed. This is wonderful news. What? He explained that he and the faculty thought of me as young, green, arrogant, wet behind the ears, inexperienced, and generally naive about the real world. Worse, he said, you think you know everything. Well, I was 21. He went on to explain that what was wrong with me could be fixed. That was the good news. What I needed to know most to become a minister was not something the school could teach me in a classroom. It wasn't in books. It wasn't in a church. What I needed to know was out there in the world. As a bartender, I would see many kinds of people with many kinds of needs. It would be a challenge to be useful and do my job and keep my values at the same time. Finally, the dean explained that being a minister was to be where you were really needed, not just safely yammering away in a pulpit on a Sunday morning. Most bars could use a minister, he thought. Jesus, he said, did not spend much time in church. Jesus, he was out in the world, working. The dean had a plan. He would consider my bartending job as a work-study program, a course in life 101. Every Monday, I would come in for an hour's conversation with him. He would ask me what I had learned behind the bar. As long as I was learning something meaningful, I could get course credit. Such a deal. Keep your eyes open. Suspend judgment. Be useful, were his final instructions. Well, I tended bar for almost 3 years. The learning never ended. I discovered how willing people were to tell their life stories to a bartender, and not only did they have great problems, they sometimes had great solutions. Not many ministers have bartending 101, 102, and 103 as part of their education. When I graduated 3 years later, the dean gave me a fine evaluation. I had passed his bartending test. I knew a whole lot more about the world and my place in it, a whole lot more about me. He did make one final troubling comment. On paper, he said, Fulgham is not as good as he thinks he is. What? I was now 24. Don't worry, he said. Be patient. In time, you may be better than you think you are. Remember, keep your eyes open, suspend judgment, be useful. As long as learning on my mind, I'll tell you one more learning story. It's called Help, but it's about the same man, Dean Bartlett, theological school. This time, it's a couple of months before graduation. The pressure of studies had forced me to give up my bartending job, and there were no immediate prospects for a job after seminary. I was 24. I had a wife and a baby son, and I was flat broke for the first time in my life. I was scared. So I went to the dean to explain my plight and ask for help. Once again, he surprised me. "Wonderful," he exclaimed. "This is wonderful news."
"What?"
"You are a stubbornly proud young man. You are independent to a fault. Nothing really wrong with that in itself, but we thought you would never learn how or when to ask anyone for help. How can you be a minister, be in the profession of helping others, if you don't know what it's like to need help yourself? Now you know how it feels to have to ask for help." He paused to let that powerful admonition sink in. "We will help you," he said. "You are worth helping." He paused again. "And before I go on, think about how you felt when I said that. Lovely words. We will help you. You are worth helping." Lesson two for the day. Dean Bartlett explained the next step for me was to prepare and submit a budget. Give the budget to his secretary, come back the next day, help would be ready in the form of a check. Greatly relieved, I went home and carefully, thoughtfully crafted a tight but reasonable budget. Took the budget to the secretary, went back the next day for the check. "Sorry," she said, "but the dean says your budget is unacceptable." Well, I felt bad about that. I must have asked for too much. So I revised the budget downward to a bread and water and rent and utilities level, took the budget back to the secretary, returned the next day. "Sorry," she said, "but the dean says your budget is still unacceptable." Well, angry and confused and upset, I opened the dean's office door without knocking, and I unloaded my frustration on him. "You said you'd help me. You said I was worth helping, but you won't accept my budget. You know I can't live on less. What the hell is going on?" He smiled. "Wonderful," he said. "Just wonderful." I collapsed in a chair, realizing I was going to learn something again. "Now that your fit is over, would you like to know exactly why your budget is unacceptable to me and this educational institution?" "Well, yeah, I'd like to know." "Listen to me carefully. There is nothing in your budget for joy. No book, no flowers, no music, not even a cold beer. And there is nothing in your budget to give away to someone else." And then he hit me right between the eyes. "We don't help people who don't have better values than you do." Wham! Nothing for joy. Nothing to give away. No help for people who don't have better values than I. Lesson three. Lesson learned. There was much joy in my next budget, believe me. And the dean approved it. But it wasn't until I told someone else this story that I realized that what I had to give away was this story itself. And now you have it. Here's an old story that is too true to change. It's called Stuff. Moving is a blow to my self-image. I like to think I am reasonably clean and tidy, but comes that moment, after all the furniture and possessions have been removed from my rooms, and I come back to see if I've left anything, and I look at the floor, and there's all this stuff around. Behind where the desk was, and behind where the bookcase was, and behind where the bed was, and in the corner once occupied by the chest of drawers, stuff. Gray, fuzzy, hairy, grotty stuff. "Look at all that dirt," I think. "I am not so very nice and clean after all," I think. "What would the neighbors think?" I think. "What would my mother say?" I think. "What if they come to inspect?" I think. "I've got to clean it up quick," I think. "This stuff, it's always there when I move. What is it?" Well, I read in a medical journal that a laboratory analyzed this stuff. They were working on the problems of people with allergies, but their results apply here. The findings about stuff? Particles of wool, cotton, and paper. Bug chunks. Food. Plants, tree leaves, ash, microscopic spores of fungi, and single-celled animals. And a lot of unidentifiable odds and ends, mostly natural and organic. But that's just the miscellaneous list. The majority of stuff comes from just two sources. People, exfoliated skin and hair, and meteorites, disintegrated as they hit the Earth's atmosphere. No kidding, it's true, tons of it fall every day. So, in other words, what's behind my bed and bookcase and dresser and chest is mostly me and stardust. A botanist told me that if you gather up a bunch of this stuff in a jar, put some water in it and let it sit in the sunlight and then plant a seed in it, the seed will grow like crazy. Or if you do the same thing but put it in a damp, dark place, mushrooms will grow in it. And then, of course, if you eat the mushrooms, you may see stars. This all begins to work together. Also, if you really want to see a lot of it, take the sheet off your bed, shake it hard in a dark room, and then turn on a beamed flashlight. There you are, like the little snowman in the round glass ball on the mantel at Grandma's house. London Bridge is falling down, and the stars are falling down, and I'm falling down, and everything else is falling down to go around again, some say. Scientists have pretty well established that we come from a stellar birthing room. We are the stuff of stars. And there, behind my desk, I seem to be returning to my source in a quiet way, recombining with the stuff of the universe into who knows what. So I have a heightened respect for what's going on in the nooks and crannies of my room. It isn't dirt. It's all compost. Cosmic compost. This next essay is about vacuums. A man I had not seen in years stopped me on the street recently. He once was a nodding acquaintance neighbor who lived up the end of the block. "How's business?" I asked, and he came back with, "Business really sucks," and laughed. I knew he was going to say this. It's been his trademark quip for years, because he's a regional sales manager for a vacuum cleaner company, so his business really does suck. His humor is tacky, but I like his enthusiasm and the confidence he has in his product line. Quote, "Anything you want to suck up or blow away anywhere, anytime, we got the machine," he says. Handy vac, shop vac, super vac, specialty rigs to clean out chimneys and furnaces. He's got built-in systems for whole buildings, vacuum cleaners to slurp up chemical and oil pollutants, and he's got blowers, leaf blowers, grass blowers, underwater trash blower systems for pools. Indoors, outdoors, on the ground, in the sea, or in the sky, no task too big or small. It's a large company, and he's been their gold medal salesman for years. "Stand back! Give me air!" is his war cry. He's a character. His personal hero is a man named James Murray Spengler. In 1907, Spengler was a janitor in a department store in Ohio, but he was going to have to give up his job because the mechanical carpet sweeper he had to use kicked up so much dust and mold he had chronic allergy problems. So Spengler solved his problem by inventing the first vacuum cleaner. You'd laugh to see the original model, made out of a pillowcase, soapbox, a fan, and yards of tape. Still, the device not only worked, it solved Spengler's allergy problems and saved his career as a janitor. You've probably never heard of Spengler, because he sold the patent to a man whose name you do know, William Hoover. My friend, the salesman, reveres Spengler because he took common items he found at home and, using the most obvious natural resource, air, he changed domestic history. I don't know how many times I've heard this story from my former neighbor, but it is a good story. And when he told it to me one more time last week, I couldn't resist asking him once again if he was still a hypocrite. He blushed and smiled and said, "Yeah." Perhaps hypocrite is not quite the word. Maybe philosopher is the right word. I'll explain the accusation and you can decide. Early on in our neighbor experience, I noticed a profound contradiction in the life of this air salesman. It puzzled me. I'd be out in my yard and would look up and see him mowing his yard with an old hand-powered push mower. Then he would pile up the grass clippings using an equally old-fashioned hand rake. Finally, he would sweep his sidewalk and driveway with a classic straight broom and pick up the piles with a dustpan. In the fall, he raked his leaves by hand, no blower. And when he tidied his car, he swept it out with a whisk broom. So where was all the machinery that sucked things up and blew things away, you might ask? One day I confronted him, and he confessed. He had once tried to sell his wares to an Amish farmer in Iowa whose religious and social values did not allow the use of electricity and gasoline engines. See, the Amish believe that those things that do not serve the family, the community, or the individual well should be avoided. Noisy engines separate people and make it hard for them to sing together while they work, and even harder to think when they work alone. Hand tools are cheap, easy to repair, and give the user good exercise. Speed and efficiency do not always increase the quality of life, so say the Amish. And so when my friend's life gets to be too much of an air raid and he needs sanity, he remembers the Amish. He goes out into his yard with his hand tools for an afternoon of seeking wisdom in simplicity. A noisy machine won't help him at all when his soul feels empty. In his middle years, he has acquired the wisdom of choosing appropriate technology. Pushing leaves with mechanical air is not the same as hearing the wind blow through the trees. Here's one of my all-time favorite stories, absolutely unchanged. It's called The Mermaid. Giants, wizards, and dwarfs was the game to play. Being left in charge of about 80 children, 7 to 10 years old, while their parents were off doing parenty things, I mustered my troops in the church social hall and explained the game. It's a large-scale version of rock, paper, and scissors and involves some intellectual decision-making. But the real purpose of the game is to make a lot of noise and run around chasing people until nobody knows which side you're on or who won. Organizing a room full of wired-up grade schoolers into two teams, explaining the rudiments of the game, achieving consensus on group identity, all this is no mean accomplishment, but we did it with the right goodwill and we're ready to go. The excitement of the chase had reached a critical mass. I yelled out, "You have to decide now which you are, a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf." While the groups huddled in frenzied, whispered consultation, a tug came at my pants leg. A small child stands there, looking up, and asks in a small, concerned voice, where do the mermaids stand? Where do the mermaids stand? A long pause, a very long pause. Where do the mermaids stand, says I? Yes, she says, you see, I am a mermaid. Well, there are no such things as mermaids. Oh, yes, I am one. I looked down, this child. She did not relate to being a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf. She knew her category, mermaid, and was not about to leave the game and go over and stand against the wall where a loser would stand. She intended to participate wherever mermaids fit into the scheme of things, without giving up dignity or identity. And she took it for granted that there was a place for mermaids and that I would know where that place was. Well, where do the mermaids stand? All the mermaids, all those who are different, who do not fit the norm, who do not accept the available boxes and pigeonholes. Answer that question, and you can build a school, a nation, or a world on it. So, what was my answer at the moment? Every once in a while, I do say the right thing. The mermaid stands right here, by the king of the sea, says I. And so we stood there, hand in hand, reviewing the troops of wizards and giants and dwarfs as they roiled by in wild disarray. It is not true, by the way, that mermaids do not exist. I know at least one personally. I have held her hand. Here's another mermaid story of a different order. It's New York City, winter, corner of 52nd Street and Madison Avenue, cold and wildly windy. Traffic is jammed, slammed tight. An ill-tempered mood plagues the streets, but me, I'm waving politely at taxis. Clearly, I'm from out of town. Yellow cab eases up in front of me. The driver, a massive black lady wearing a pink nylon jacket and a black turban, barks at me, a don't-mess-with-me expression on her face. You want a ride or a date or what? Yeah, I want a ride, so I get in the back seat. She turns and barks at me again. So, my man, just where are you going? Well, I'm going uptown, 91st and 5th. She laughs. Not with me, you ain't. Why not? This city is set like cement. Must be a 50-foot brick wall across Midtown. This town's always locked up for something, a parade of anything. Retired dog catchers, the Ku Klux Klan, dentist, who knows what. Could be His Blessitude the Pope is still here. Could be the president is back in town. Could be Jesus Christ himself, for all I know. He's about the only one who hasn't been here this year. She laughs again, big laugh. So, I can't get uptown? Not in this cab, not unless you want to go around by way of Chicago, but I'll take you downtown as far as you want to go. Wall Street, New Jersey, Florida, or Rio de Janeiro. I mean as far as you want to go, my man. We could have some fun going downtown, but not uptown. No way today. Well, thanks. I like your turban, by the way. What country are you from? She laughs big. The turban is just my hat. I'm from the country of New York City. Bred here, born here, grew up here, still live here, can't get away from here, and going to die here. But I keep thinking, somehow, someday, I'm leaving. But I know I'm dreaming. Maybe they'll stuff me and put me in a museum with a sign under me that says, here's the dumbest broad who ever lived. She could have left New York a long time ago and was too slow to go. So, how come you don't leave? Hey, ain't you got a list of things you should have done a long time ago? Well, yes. Well, there's your why, my man, and all the why there is. Who knows? Besides, it's dangerous and weird outside New York. Tornadoes and the woods on fire and bears and rednecks and born-agains and slow-talking people and beauty queens and cowboys and Indians, all that. I'd rather take my chances in New York City. You still don't look very happy about it. Well, I've had a bad day, my man. Like I say, the town is locked up like somebody spilled glue on a cockroach convention. Weather's bad, but not bad enough. Too many people walking. The cab is running rough. My boyfriend has run off with two other women. Not one, but two. And my rent's way overdue. No, God is definitely not on my side. But hey, rain's over. You gonna talk or you gonna ride? You know, I should pay you just to drive me around and talk to me, but I've got to go uptown to a meeting, so I'll get out. Standing by her door, I make an offer. Here's $20, a gift, just to balance out a bad day. $20? It's not enough. Not enough. If you think $20 will put me even with the craziness of New York City and the wrath of Almighty God, then you're weirder than you look, and you need the money more than I do. Here, take it back. Well, how much would pull you even? She looks at me, thinking in amused silence, laughs, holds out her hand. There's not enough money in the universe, brother. Here, give me that 20. If I didn't take what I can get, I'll never get nothing. I'm grateful, my man. Hawking and waving and laughing, she charged off into the impossible traffic, more like the driver of a tank than a taxi. Just possibly working her way uptown or beyond, somewhere, somehow, someday. Onward. Attitude's what the lady's got. It's all attitude. And she's another mermaid. Here's a new story about summer jobs. Two desperate young men were at my door one night last week. We're desperate, they said. They didn't look desperate, neat and clean, tennis shoes, jeans, T-shirts, and baseball caps on the right way. We're 15 years old, which is why they were desperate. They needed summer jobs, and nobody was hiring unless you were 16. Being 15 isn't good enough, said one, I remember. Being 15 is being in between, a transitional phase. Just how desperate are you, I ask. Oh, really desperate. We'll do anything for money. Wonderful. Actually, I had been looking for a couple of guys in this condition. See, a neighbor has been needling me about my excessive firewood. He thinks it weighs too much and is maybe